This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, feel like I'm playing opposite language in a long-running production of Waiting for Godot. Today's episode is some choice cuts from The Allusionist vault of interesting things that interviewees said that there wasn't room for in the episodes in which they originally appeared. Prepare to learn some exciting new terms, and another reason to be grateful for bears. I just wanted to tell you some good news too. After the last episode where we wrote a festive hit for 2020, we put the song Don't Wait For Me Beneath the Mistletoe by The Allusionettes on Bandcamp, Spotify, Apple, etc. I wasn't expecting anyone to buy it, but to my happy surprise, some of you did, so I thought, well, alright, whatever the song raises in sales, I will match, and then donate the whole lot to the Trussell Trust, a charity which works to stop hunger and poverty in the UK, and Hestia, a charity which supports people in crisis. And then Martin Austwick, who co-wrote the song and played instruments and did fa-la-las and things, said he would also match the sales. So, thanks to you buying the song, and each of us matching the sales, it has, at time of recording, raised £1,821 for charity. What a result! That is one thing I can be happy that 2020 hath wrought. And it's been really lovely to hear that you've added the song to your playlist. I was in the supermarket the other day and they were playing some of the classic Christmas hits about togetherness and happiness, and I was in a screaming pretty loudly. So I think us having written a 2020 appropriate alternative was the right call. And now, on with the bonus allusion bits. I've got to think of a better term. Historian Kate Lister appeared on the episode My Dad Excavated a Porno, about the history of pornography. And one theme that came up was Victorian Britain's self-flagellating attitude to sex.
Outwardly, everybody in the Victorian era was like, no, we don't, we'll behave ourselves, we don't do this. But behind closed doors, yeah, there was lots and lots of erotic art. In some of the great artists of the day were secretly doing erotic sketches. Turner, for example, Turner of the landscape. Yeah, I know, people don't know that very much about him, is when he wasn't doing these amazing landscapes, he was living with a mistress and doing lots of, he travelled around Europe, he visited lots of brothels and he sketched all the women in them. There's a really erotic and explicit images, and he filled sketchbook after sketchbook and no one knew about it. And when he died, his estate was that the executor of the state was John Ruskin, the famous Victorian prude who apparently freaked out because his wife had pubic hair, which isn't true, but he was definitely quite prudish and he was absolutely devastated when he found these drawings, because Ruskin, Turner was his absolute hero. He idolised him. He like put him on a proper pedestal. And now there's all these pictures of him shagging women. He was devastated. So he organised to have them burnt.
Oh.
Yeah. We don't think he did actually burn them because so many of them survived. They're in the Tate Museum now today. You can go and see them. But yeah, so that's Victorians in a nutshell, really, you know, to the outward world, you're painting lovely watercolours and fish and landscapes, and then in secret you're painting people shagging each other. and then you say that you'll burn them because they're so obscene, but you don't really. You just pretend that you have. That's the Victorians all over. That's it.
Something else Kate and I got to talking about was the word slut. There's lots to say about that word and its reclamation, making a note to myself to cover it properly on the show. My mother still uses the word in its original 15th century meaning of an untidy or slovenly woman. If I don't vacuum, people will think I'm a slut.
I love that. Yeah, that was because it meant originally someone that was dirty. Like it meant a woman. It was a gendered term, but it meant something that was just it was dirty. So you would say that you were a right slut, and that would mean that you were kind of lazy, like a slattern. And it's brilliant because obviously to us it has a completely different meaning. So when you're looking back at old texts and they're talking about slut holes that need clearing out, that's just, you know, like it'd make us fall about laughing, but what they actually mean was a kind of like a hole that was just full of rubbish and crap in the street, like that you'd put coal into and store there. And there's something that was called slut wool as well, slut wool. And ooh, that, like, you know when you like you lift up your sofa or the bed and there's all like, we call them dust bunnies now, like all those sort of like balls of dust. That was slut wool once upon a time. The suggestion being that you were so lazy that only lazy women have this fluff. So yeah, slut wool.
On the episode Food Into Words, we heard from Mimi A, the food writer and co-host of the MSG podcast. Here she is with the Burmese equivalent of bringing home the bacon.
A pork bun is basically, so my mum's from a town in just outside the Shan state, it's called Mogo, and basically they're kind of mad about pork there, like they'll do anything that they can with it, so they kind of dry it and turn it into, I suppose a bit like pork scratchings, but it tends to be things like the intestines, so it's like kind of very crunchy little things, and they'll pickle it and they'll make sausages and, you know, they'll make curries and stuff. But because it's so important, they don't talk about bringing home the bread, they talk about bringing home the pork, kind of. So yeah, pork fun is wetabo, which means I'm going out to earn money for pork, basically, is what they say. So
that's very motivating.
Staying with food for a moment, in the apples episode, we heard from apple historian Joanna Crosby.
There's botanical reasons why the apple is a successful fruit, in that it has evolved to be very tempting. There is a theory that the original apple was spread across Northern Europe before humans came along by bears, which I rather like this theory of bears picking apples and eating them.
And, well, and then pooping the seeds around.
Exactly, yes. So the bear does what the bear does naturally a little further along the wood, and up comes another apple tree. And apples are polymorphous, which means that each pip, when you plant it, comes up as an individual apple in its own right. So apples are like children. However many times you try, you can't get the same one twice. So each pip that you plant from your lovely apple, from, say, your Cox's orange pippin, is not going to come up as a Cox's orange pippin. It's going to come up with the characteristics of both its parents, but it will be unique and individual. So that's how you get new varieties of apple. And that's how the apple evolved into bigger, sweeter apples quite naturally before humans came along and interfered, because those were the ones that the bears and the early humans went for. So the apple realised that if it was going to get spread along, it needed to appeal to us.
Gosh, so a lot of our apple varietals have been determined by the taste of bears.
Well, it could be, yes. Certainly by the taste of bears and early man and anything else eating it along, yes.
And apples also snuck into languages.
The Celts have a whole beautiful language to do with apples, and lots of folk stories to do with apples. Probably the most well-known one is the Isle of Avalon, where King Arthur was taken after the last battle, and where apparently he lies in rest and will one day return to save Britain. But the Isle of Avalon means the Isle of Apples. So Ava in the Celtic language is apple. And there's lots of different stories about magical apples, apples that sing to you, and apples that however much of it you eat, it never grows any less.
Do you think you would want an apple to sing to you?
I would be somewhat alarmed, I think, if I had a singing apple. But on the other hand, I could be a hit on YouTube, so who knows?
It's a very pragmatic attitude. I wonder if as you bite into the apple, it starts to scream instead of sing.
Yeah, that would not be good.
In the celebrity episode, historian and writer and broadcaster Greg Jenner talked about the history of celebrity, having just written a book about it called Dead Famous. What are your feelings about couple portmanteaus? And also any idea when those erupted?
Yeah.
Did Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks have Fairford or anything?
Roughly the right era. The earliest one I'm aware of is Cléo de Merode and Leopold of Belgium, King of Belgium. They were allegedly a couple, although she denied it, and they become Cléopold.
Ah, it's too perfect. Of course you would have to do it.
And this was in the 1890s. So Cléopold was Cléo plus Leo, Cléopold, which is quite good. And so in 1927, while making the film Flesh and the Devil, John Gilbert and Greta Garbo got together, and it was pretty controversial because he was already married, but they ended up with a couple portmanteau name of Gilbo, which was not universally liked. And in fact, the Gilbo was a pejorative. They were sort of booed, really, for their sordid affair. So, yeah, Gilbo and Cléopold are the two earliest ones I'm aware of. And that's, 100 years ago and 120 years ago.
Wow, so Brangelina were very late.
Oh, yeah.
Bennifer, way behind.
Exactly.
Maybe you associate the word glamour with celebs. Well, get ready for some yikes.
Glamour comes from a medieval Scottish word meaning a book containing witchcraft. It was a book containing, or a cult, alchemy. So it comes from the Scottish word gramara, or gramary, and it was essentially a dictionary of spells. And what's interesting about glamour is that we now kind of used it to mean like anyone who just looks nice and
got a hairdo.
They've got the hairdo, they've done some lippy. But glamour, when it was first used in the film industry in the 1920s and 30s, particularly in the 30s, really, what people were meaning is a seductive visual spell. You're basically, you're drinking the spell through your eyes and you are under the spell of this star. And you have to remember that cinema projected these images onto big screens. So these people were huge and you would be gazing into their faces, and the invention of the close-up is a hugely important moment. And so glamour was not just about people looking fancy. It was actually seduction.
But it also sounds like quite a negative thing, where you're saying to people, you're going to be seduced by this person, but it's unfair because they're using a supernatural tool that's at their disposal, and it's also kind of false.
Yeah. And you also had in the 19th century an obsession with charismatic leadership and people giving great speeches and orators, and this idea that you could influence a crowd, you could get a mob to change their mind by convincing them with specific gestures, specific language. There was one particular speech kind of therapist guy who developed a series of gestures and a series of sounds, and he practiced in his house for months on end, flailing his arms around and screaming and bellowing.
James Rush.
James Rush, thank you. These were taught to orators, to speakers. So James Rush taught people how to convince a crowd, to get a mob on side, by using these vocal and bodily sort of pyrotechnics, if you will. So that's a technique. That's something you could learn. And, you know, we still see that now with modern politicians, the way they're taught to stand with their legs quite wide in a power stance, the way they're told not to point their fingers because it's aggressive. So they put their thumb inside their fist. All those sort of body language ticks and cues go back to the 19th century. So it's quite interesting to see the history of glamour as a kind of the idea of being manipulated. Well, actually, that's older. You know, the idea of manipulation goes back to the idea of mesmerism and magnetism and influential people in the 19th century who can change minds.
Mesmerism, eponym alert! In the celebrity episode, Greg talked about the religious etymology of words like fame and charisma. And here's another one, fan.
I mean, the word fan obviously has very strong religious connotations, because it derives from fanaticus, which is Latin relating to a shrine. And so fandom is a pretty modern word. I think fandom dates to very early 1900s. And fan itself, in the context we use it, dates to sort of late 1800s. And that initially, I think, was used for baseball fans. So I think it starts with sport. So fans were people who liked baseball. But fanatic was used in the 17th century for people who were kind of religiously crazed and over the top and were not praying to the right god or whatever. And fanaticus is ancient and speaks to shrines and religious behavior. So someone who is a fan now is probably in no way thinking that they are doing anything religious. It's probably not at all a religious connotation for them. But the linguistic heritage does go very quickly back to religious affairs, I suppose. And we get, obviously, fan culture that's now turned into stan culture and stanning, and that is not religious, but the idea of stan culture is that it's an obsessive fandom, like it's over the top fandom, that you're too invested, you might end up doing something stupid or dangerous.
And that's from the Eminem song Stan.
Eminem song Stan, about a guy who goes too far. So it's quite fun, actually, that the history of fandom has gone through a few changes and iterations and linguistic leaps, but also its meaning seems to have changed too.
With a lot of the words, like celebrity, fame a bit, and definitely charisma, there is a religious or divine link in a lot of the words.
Yeah. And there is a long-standing, tradition is not the word really, but there's a long-standing attempt to try and see if celebrity is some sort of religion replacement. You know, lots of sociologists in the 20th century said, well, look, clearly humans like worshipping stuff. If you travel around the world and visit various different communities in different parts of the world, or if you look in the ancient, back to the Stone Age and whatever, we can always find some sort of religious behaviour. And clearly celebrity culture is just the latest in the form of religious behaviour. We're replacing God with photographs of Harry Styles. And as handsome as he is, I don't quite believe that. I'm not totally convinced by that. I think it's an interesting theory to sort of chat about, but that feels to me a bit reductive. But the idea of religion as being something innately hardwired into us is also something that evolutionary psychologists talk about, the idea that we have an urge to worship, and so we can't help but do this. In the same way that sheepdogs, if you bring them indoors, will start herding furniture because they're like, I have to herd things. I've got to herd stuff. What else you got? Chairs. Oh, that's fine. It doesn't need to be sheep. So again, I'm not particularly convinced of that, but I'm not an evolutionary psychologist, so what do I know? But from my point of view, I think there are definitely commonalities in the way that we gather as friends, as fans, to congregate, to form a congregation, and we can certainly be reverential in touching relics, in collecting relics, whether that's ticket stubs or autographs, signed t-shirts, you know, the drummer's sticks that he's thrown from the front of the stage.
There was that person who was trying to sell Britney Spears' fart in a jar years ago. So you can't even smell it unless you're willing to let it go forever.
That, oh, that's amazing, isn't it?
It's Schrodinger's fart.
Schrodinger's fart.
I don't know if that works. In the episode, Survival, Custodians of the Languages, Rudy Bremer talked about the many languages belonging to First Nations people of Australia.
From an Aboriginal or from an Indigenous perspective, we refer to ourselves as Black regardless of skin tone. It can throw people a little bit. And I'll be honest, I don't entirely know where it came from. We also have, I use white fellas pretty kind of in a pretty particular way. Whitefella and blackfella. But gubba is one of, like, it's a word that gets used about white people or to refer to white people. And it's one that you really only use if you don't like the person you're talking about. And somebody finally explained to me that gubba is almost definitely an Aboriginalization of governor or government, but when you talk about someone being a gub or being a gubba, like, it's not a nice thing. It's not something you want to, you wouldn't describe your white friends as being gubs unless they'd really annoyed you.
Unless they'd come and taken your land and killed your people.
Yeah. But the way that we use black and black fellas, because we also say fella as a gender-neutral term. I think Australians have a tendency to use a lot of terms in a gender-neutral way. We've taken the word fireman and turned it into fireys, which...
That works.
In the same way that we've taken, like, tradesmen and we call them tradies. Like, we've dropped man from a lot of things.
This is brilliant.
We just, yeah, sort of accidentally became really gender progressive in our language.
Just because everything sounds like a nickname.
Yeah, just because we're lazy.
Well, that would fix some of the problems with gender in language that I brought up in No Title. On the New Rules episode, Gretchen McCulloch talked about how language develops online, as detailed in her very useful book, Because Internet. There's always some evolution that makes you wonder if everyone else met up behind your back to decide how it all works now.
I've been doing some looking into email etiquette because, you know, I have a lot of friends who are linguists, and as I've aged, they've aged with me, and so now I have a lot of friends who are linguistics professors. And you get people periodically being like, oh my god, why can't my student send me an email? Why do they keep sending an email like this? And so I've been exposed to a lot of, like, professors complaining about student email. And one of the things that at least the kind of professor generation, even though the professors are sometimes like 30, think is that, you know, its emails should probably begin with dear or maybe hi, but like hey is definitely too informal. And even hi is kind of suspectly informal. And yet younger people that I've posed this question to are really against dear because for them it actually feels like an endearment.
Mm.
It's like, my dearest professor so-and-so, my darling professor so-and-so. That would be weird. And to a younger generation, at least some members of it, deer is beginning to fall in that category where it seems uncomfortably literal now, despite the fact that it, you know, it went through this long period when it wasn't literal. Of course, it started out as literal, and it's regaining its literality as it becomes less common again.
I mean, it is a weird one.
It is a weird one. You know, why do we address perfect strangers as dear sir? Like, you're not my darling. You're not my lover. You're not my family member. Like, I'm not a dear sir or madam. Like, who even are you? And yet I'm addressing you with this endearment. It's very strange.
Yeah, it's odd that such a kind of warm word then became this very formal, almost froder-laced term.
Yeah, this semantically bleached word, which just like the meaning just washes out because you use it so much. But then if you aren't exposed to it in those formal contexts, you look at it and you're like, yep, I know what this word means. This is an endearment. I'm not using an endearment with my professor because that would be uncomfortably intimate and I'm not doing that. And so they don't think of it as a formality thing at all. It's like, this is something that's uncomfortable. Whereas if you say hi or hello or hey or something, like that's an acceptable greeting in person. Like you don't go up to their professor in the hallway and say, you know, dear professor, whatever. You know, why would you do it in an email? Whereas you would say hi to your professor in a hallway, so you could say that in an email. At least this is the perspective that I'm getting from younger people.
I was thinking, gosh, it's so difficult really to deduce what emotions are accompanying written words in the internet age because the styles and indicators change pretty rapidly. But presumably that's the case in the history of writing. I could be interpreting things completely incorrectly for the emotion the writer intended and thought that they signposted, but I don't recognize the signposts of like what they meant in 1800 and whatnot.
Yeah, there's this really interesting example of this from the musical Hamilton, where you have these two founding fathers, you know, Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr, exchanging a series of letters, which culminate in them fighting a duel. So this is an acrimonious exchange of letters. And yet they end all of the letters to each other as your obedient servant. Clearly, they don't mean that they are actually obedient or servants, because they end up fighting a duel. Like, they're not, you know, they're not pleasant letters. And yet they have these stylistic pleasantries that are just so conventional for the era as to be essentially meaningless, that they're just using because that's what you do in a letter. And to the modern listener, to the modern reader, to Lin-Manuel Miranda, writing Hamilton, this comes off as dramatic irony. So there's a song in Hamilton that has your obedient servant repeated in it about this acrimonious exchange, and the modern audience perceives irony there. But the historical audience wouldn't have. So which of our things that seem just completely washed out and rote formal politenesses will become literal again in another 200 years? I think it's a really interesting question. If I had a crystal ball, I'd love to answer it. There's this stock phrase in French that you put at the end of business letters, which is, je vous assure, monsieur, l'expression de mes sentiments les plus distingués, which means something like, I assure you, sir, of the expression of my most distinguished sentiments or something like this.
Wow.
It really doesn't have much meaning. It's just very formal. But like, that's just what you say. If you're writing a cover letter for your resume, that's just what you say in French to convey this is the end of a formal letter. And I remember trying to parse this as somebody learning French and just thinking, what on earth is this? But of course, if that's, you know, you're just exposed to it as that's what you say, it's a stock phrase, then you keep using it because everyone else is.
Yeah, that's that feedback loop again, isn't it? And presumably it's in letter writing guidelines that that's what you do. So when will it change?
Exactly. And if you don't do it, that's a sign that you don't know what the expectations are. And so it's self-reinforcing. And like, if you're going to have a formal context, like a cover letter for a job application is one place to have a very formal context. Like a resume is a completely artificial document, but it shows that you're fluent with a certain set of expectations. But, you know, there's space for lots of different styles. There's space for lots of different levels of formality when it comes to clothing or when it comes to food or when it comes to all of these other areas. So there can be space for these different types of styles when it comes to language.
This summer on Blood Is Not Water, Anthony Russell, Arun Viswanath and Jonah Boyarin talked about translating Black Lives Matter into Yiddish. This was not Jonah's first time translating protest slogans into Yiddish.
When I was TAing at the Yiddish Book Center last summer, there were protests in Western Massachusetts, as there were across the country, against ICE, our American immigration authorities, which are detaining in detention centers immigrant children and separating them from their families in a systematic and cruel way. And in particular, a lot of the protests last summer, a lot of them were led by Jewish organizations. It's an issue that for different historical and immediate reasons, are very close to a lot of Jewish people's hearts. So one such action was being organized in Western Massachusetts during this summer Yiddish program. And I organized a group of faculty and students to go. And as we were preparing, you know, all the students who were in this immersive Yiddish experience were saying, what kind of signs do we write? What kind of signs do we write? You know, when you're a beginner intermediate student and you're going through every day in your dorm and like learning how to say, you know, I boiled the rice in Yiddish or pass the pepper in Yiddish, you're also going to want to say, you know, a world without borders in Yiddish, you know? And so I was fielding a lot of these questions as a TA. And as part of that process, their questions prompted me to come up with a slogan at the time, which was Ois Ice, which means out with ice or down with ice, which I had come up with because I had read or reread for the third or fourth time that very summer Shalom Aleichem, great Yiddish writer's story called Kippur's Chicken, something like that. At any rate, it's a story about a group of chickens who in their local shtetl go on strike against the tradition of being sacrificed each year during the high holidays to expiate the local townspeople's sins. And as they go on strike, they march around saying, Ois Kippuris, Ois Kippuris. So I said, you know what? I think I know how to say in Yiddish. I've never been to a Yiddish-speaking protest in my life. I've been to a million protests, but I've never been to a Yiddish-speaking protest. But from the Shalom Aleichem story, I'm inferring that you can say Ois X, you know, out with X. So I said, Ois Ice, that works. And we fashioned signs accordingly. I sent to some friends who were organizing Never Again actions in DC and elsewhere, and sashes were made with these words on them and corresponding words in English and in Spanish. I got a little bit of pushback from one of my colleagues who said, actually, it should be Ois mit Ice, down with ice. And I said, here's how I know why it's Ois Ice, because it's in the Shalom Aleichem story. And we had a really beautiful experience going to the protest, participating as everyone else did, singing everyone's chants, and also holding up our signs in Yiddish and being in that tradition. And I also tell this story to say these things were generated quite consciously. I had to learn or infer how to write a snappy Yiddish protest sign or slogan from an 100-year-old Yiddish story. And the reason that I have to infer that is because the chain of Yiddish transmission has been cut by coerced and incentivized assimilation, being dissociated both from our own tongues, our own Yiddish tongues, and also from our more radical roots.
I love the fact that like Ois Ice came from chickens who were protesting. The beginnings of a vocabulary for Yiddish protest took place in the farmyard of a shtetl far away from here. I'm like, my mind is blown. I'm literally gonna, as soon as we get off of this, I'm gonna talk to my husband about it for at least an hour.
We're constantly working to sort of demonstrate to ourselves that life can be lived in this language. And that Shalom Aleichem's story about the chicken striking, which is another way of saying, well, really, he was drawing on stories of the Yiddish proletariat going on mass strikes, that's relevant history now in some way that we can draw on it now.
Because of the way in which the use of Yiddish has eroded in uneven ways across the Ashkenazic Jewish community, people have linguistic intuitions about Yiddish that they feel very, very strongly about. And some of those people may be native speakers who have different intuitions than my own intuitions or somebody else's. And some of them may not be native Yiddish speakers and may have intuitions about Yiddish that they're very, very sure about, which I think creates some interesting challenges.
Yiddish as a language has this sort of like totemic quality where people want to know what certain things in that language sound like because it connects them to certain parts of themselves. It connects them with an amazing sort of history. Basically, the communities of Yiddish are shaped, oddly enough, like a bagel, and there's like nothing in the middle. So you have to inhabit, the middle in order to connect with the rest of the parts of the bagel.
I'm hungry now.
I think that metaphor could use some sesame seeds and poppy seeds and onion pieces on top.
Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is patulous. Adjective, rare. Spreading wide like the branches of a tree. That's a nice one to end the year on. Thanks, dictionary. Try using patulous in an email today. And thank you for your support this year, listening to episodes, snoozing to the Tranquillusionists, and becoming patrons on Patreon as the show became independent. I will return with new episodes towards the end of January 2021, but here's a boring warning. The show's feed is about to change, so hopefully it'll go smoothly and you will not notice a thing, you will not have to do anything. But if it gets to, say, mid-February, and you don't see new Illusionist episodes appearing in your pod feed, then try unsubscribing and resubscribing, or search for the show in whichever app you use to listen to podcasts. It's going to be fine. Don't worry about it. It's going to be fine. And if in doubt, you can always find every episode of the show and transcripts and additional information and the full dictionary entries for the randomly selected words at the show's forever home, theillusionist.org.